Hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and today's podcast is going to blow you out of the water. We are talking to Dr. Elizabeth Urth. She is amazing. She specializes in peptides, longevity treatments, managing your hormones. She specializes in really innovating this next level of what we need to be doing in aesthetics. I'm so excited to introduce you to her. She runs the Boulder Longevity Institute. She also teaches online courses regarding all these topics. So for those of you who are in aesthetics and you're wanting to dive in and bring this into your business, take some notes and join up for her classes. And let me introduce you guys to Dr. Elizabeth Urth. Welcome, Dr. Urth.
Thank you so much, Dr. K. I love bringing this stuff together like you're doing is such a cool thing, because I think, you know, we always think kind of, you know, outside, and now we're starting to get a lot more of that. Okay, what can we do internally that's going to fix things externally? So the nice combination is so important. So I love bringing this in, especially peptides, because it's one of my passions, and you can do so much with them. So, you know, I'm thrilled that, I don't get to lecture in this format a lot, in, you know, with the more aesthetic crowd. So, and it's such a great tie-in.
It really is. I noticed that at biohacker meetings, that I'll go and look at these biohackers. They're doing amazing stuff, but they look very weathered and old.
Yeah, that's true.
I need to help him with his face. These folks are gaunt and very thin.
I know. I was just talking to you before the program. I'm the same way. It's like, you know, I do all this stuff, but there are certain things that you're going to have to intervene with, because you just can't. You know, there's certain things with aging that are just going to happen despite everything we're doing to fight it. And the aesthetic side becomes horribly important, because that's what we look at. You know, people looking like, oh gosh, well, you know, when you look at yourself and you look old, you feel older.
It's true. No one knows your biological markers, like how chronic.
Exactly. Yeah. Really, my biologic age is great. And you're like, well, yeah, look 80. You know.
The thing is, the skin is such a physical organ that it's going to get weathered. It's like a piece of paper. The more you have expressions and fold and crink, the crinkles stay if you fold the paper 1,000 times. So, like, there's so many things we need to do externally to reflect that internal beauty. But you started out in orthopedic surgery. Can you tell me a little bit about your journey from orthopedics to getting?
Yeah, I mean, because that's kind of weird, right? Most doctors don't go this realm. But I was doing orthopedics for a long time, and probably about 18 years ago now, I started to get this kind of frustration with, you know, I never really felt like we got people better. You would, you know, somebody would hurt themselves, you'd stick steroid in, you'd do a surgery, you finally replace the joint, then the next joint would go. And certainly as we age, that became worse and worse and worse, right? The ability to actually truly recover. Mm-hmm. So even if you did a surgery or, you know, got somebody temporarily better, they were never the way they were before. So I started to explore, well, how can we use other things like hormones, like peptides, like nutrients, to actually help people heal? So I went back and got training through American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, learned all, you know, the hormone courses, took nutrition courses, and started incorporating that into my orthopedic practice, which, as you can imagine, didn't work great, because in 15 minutes trying to talk to people about their hormones and their nutrients and peptides didn't work. And progressively, I found myself getting more and more frustrated because I didn't have time. I wouldn't even tell people about it. So 17 years ago, we opened Boulder Longevity Institute. And what I would do is wear my orthopedic hat all day, and I would go to Boulder Longevity Institute at night, and people would maybe see me at both places, and I would try and sort of fix them more holistically at Boulder Longevity Institute, and then just, you know, play the regular orthopedic game all day. And then really, and I did that for a long time, until really about 5 years ago, when one of my partners came up to me and chastised me for ordering labs on a patient, you know, to kind of look at their overall health. And he said, you know, we don't do medicine here. We do orthopedics. You've got to stop doing medicine because it takes too much time. And I'm like, okay, well, obviously I really don't fit in here. So I left the orthopedic practice, brought, you know, still do a lot of orthopedics, but all regenerative, much like you, you know, who went from doing a lot more surgeries. And I know you still do surgery, but doing more what you can do regeneratively, right, is so robust. And so I find myself now being able to treat most things appropriately with regenerative therapies, with optimization of health, and doing a lot less knee. Obviously, you break a bone, you still need to go to your surgeon and have surgery. But for a lot of things, we should be able to prevent degenerative joint disease, joint pain. It's all an inflammatory disease of aging, just like brain health and cardiovascular health. So that kind of, you know, we brought everything over here, which has been much, much better for my life, and I think for patients' lives. So we put it all together. We have a now practice that does a lot of regenerative orthopedics, but also does a lot of just whole body medicine.
You're just doing mainly regenerative medicine, no more orthopedic joint injections.
Yeah, so we do a lot of regenerative orthopedics because even when you do joint injections, you've got to get somebody healthy enough. Honestly, if you just stick platelets into a knee or stem cells into a knee or exosomes into a knee and the person is not physically well, they are not going to do well. And that's the problem with all these clinics that are just doing, you know, regenerative ortho and not treating the whole body. You have to get inflammatory markers down. You have to get people to be healthy. You have to give them what they need to heal. So we actually kind of always in every realm treat the whole patient to an extent, right? We don't go as deep dive with the orthopedic patients as we might with somebody who's coming to me for optimization and longevity and performance, but they at least get a piece of saying, okay, you know, your inflammatory markers are high. We need to do this, this, this before we ever start putting stuff into your knee. Otherwise, you're spending thousands of dollars. It's not going to do any good.
Interesting, because so many people are spending so much money on
right
therapy and joint injections, stem cell things, and like they haven't fixed who they are.
They haven't fixed, right. They haven't fixed why the joint got there in the first place. Yeah. There's a reason your joint got degenerative. You know, we used to think osteoarthritis was a wear and tear disease. It's been well proven that it is not. It is, you know, just like your brain shouldn't wear out or your heart shouldn't wear out, your joints should not wear out. And just like your brain wears out and your heart wears out, that's an inflammatory disease process. So even if you have trauma, yes, that sets you up, but if you are in a good state, you'll heal the trauma. Most of us have other, you know, either genetically or lifestyle factors that have made us not be able to recover. We get into this prolonged pro-inflammatory state that just continues to break down cartilage. And that's the degenerative joint disease. It's not because you banged the cartilage and now it's damaged. It's because of the process that your body did afterwards. And that's what people need to realize. So if I take somebody who's in that state, they're in a pro-inflammatory state, they've broken down all their cartilage, and I stick platelets in there, what's going to happen? They're just going to destroy whatever you tried to do.
Yeah.
So you've got to actually, you know, get rid of the bad cytokines first. You have to basically make sure people are optimized first, and then the procedures work significantly better.
But I think that's so critical. I think what you said about, I heard you say that in other countries that these surgeries where they're looking, doing arthroscopies and cleaning up joints and, you know, shaving cartilage away, et cetera, that's not even done anymore.
They don't even allow it. Over the age of 40, you're not allowed to do just an arthroscopic surgery for a meniscal tear, a degenerative meniscal tear, because it's been well established that that makes it worse. That when you go in there and muck around, all you're doing is creating more of a pro-inflammatory reaction, and that person will maybe feel better temporarily, but they will have significantly more arthritis a year later than the person who did not have surgery. And yet it's a bread and butter surgery here, right? It is, you go in with a degenerative meniscal tear, 50, 60, I don't care how old you are, and you don't get better with a little steroid and a little PT. What next step is to do an arthroscopic surgery that now has so many studies. You can't, you know, so many studies to show it is a flawed surgery that is not of any use, and yet we continue to do it here in the U.S.
That's so crazy to me that that's like an orthopedic standard of care in the U.S.
It's standard care, exactly. And you will feel better for a little while because, yeah, you kind of stirred up a little stuff, but you're not going to sustain. And again, great studies that show a year later, post-surgery, those patients look much worse. Their arthritis has significantly worsened over the group who treated that conservatively. And that was treated conservatively without doing regenerative procedures. Add the regenerative procedures in there, and you're going to look significantly better than that. So
now what are you recommending for your regenerative joint or your arthritic joint patients?
The first thing we always do is when you look at what really happens in joint arthritis is there's very high levels of some of the inflammatory cytokines, specifically something called interleukin-1 beta, nuclear factor kappa beta. There's very, very high synovial levels of all of these inflammatory cytokines. Again, if I put cells into that state, it's not going to do well. So what we do is we use primarily a drug called pentosan polysulfate, which is a repurposed drug. It's a very interesting drug. It came out, it started being used for orthopedics first in Australia in about 2019. So not yet approved here in the U.S. for orthopedic use. It will be. It's a drug called xylosol here in the U.S. It's in phase 3 trial, so probably another 2 years it will be approved for joint arthritis. But in Australia, where they've been using it now for a while, it's reversed the need for total joints by almost 90%. Is that much of what we call disease-modifying agent for osteoarthritis, or DMAO. And So we were able to get that drug compounded. And the reason is because it is available as an oral medication here in the U.S. called Elmeron. Elmeron is used for bladder inflammation and at a high dose. Problem with Elmeron is, and it's great for bladder cystitis, but what they found is after a long period of time on a high dose of this drug, that there was a possibility, small, about 0.1%, of people developed an irreversible retinopathy. That, so the drug has a big black box warning on it. The dose that we would need for arthritis, used as an injectable drug, it would take you about 100 years to ever reach that dose, and then it's only in 0.1% of people. We actually don't even know if it would ever cause that, because it may be systemically different when you give it as an injection versus orally. But it's a godsend for osteoarthritis. I can tell you I have horrible osteoarthritis in my knees. I've had 4 ACL reconstructions, retore my ACLs, and said, okay, I'm not fixing this again. I have end-stage arthritis. If you looked at my knee x-rays, you'd be like, okay, she just needs a joint replacement. But they do not hurt. I'm totally functional on them. I can do anything I want to do with my knees. You know, don't look at the x-rays. The interesting thing, too, about Pattinson is it actually is regenerating. We're seeing cartilage space over a year's period of time on this drug improve about 23%. The group off this drug on a placebo dropped cartilage space by 6%. So we're actually improving cartilage. And that's because the body can heal if you stop the inflammation and you get the things on board. So what Pattinson does is it blocks all the inflammatory things that are pertinent to causing osteoarthritis. So we get people on that medication first. And that way, we're getting rid of all those processes that are causing the degradation of the joint. Lots of times. A few months on that, they actually don't want us to do anything else because they're doing great. And they're like, okay, I don't need the injection, right? But at that stage, once we've got things settled down, we feel like they're in a good state, we've sometimes used a few peptides on board too. Then we will do usually platelet fiber matrix with exosomes or a procedure called alpha-2 macroglobulin, which is a very cool procedure, where you actually take a protein out of the blood called A2M. Alpha-2 macroglobulin is floating around your body trying to heal things. Mm-hmm. It almost looks like a little Pac-Man. And it basically picks up some of these inflammatory cytokines in the joint and it eliminates them. But we just don't have enough. So if I can take a bunch of it out of your blood, condense it, and put it back into the joint, I can markedly reduce inflammation. So sometimes if we can't get inflammation under control with things like penicillin, we'll do A2M injections, simple procedure. You just draw your blood. We spin out the A2M through a very specific filter, inject that back into the joint. That drops the inflammation down. And then now if you're still hurting, we'll go on to do platelets, exosome stem cells, whatever it might be. So the whole key here, and why I get really upset when I start seeing these drive-through people. I mean, I saw the other day somebody advertising. They drive around in a van and do joint injections, right? I'm like, okay.
God.
I think that that's not the way we're going to get people better, right? I mean, it's in your business, if you do a facelift on somebody or you do some aesthetic procedure and they still have no hormones and they still eat like crap, so all they do is eat sugar all day long and they still, you know, are not doing any of the self-care things, they're going to rapidly go back to looking the way they did, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing's
true. I wonder why some people have a beautiful response to collagen stimulators and they just like really turn the corner, and other people have zero response. And I'm sure it's all lifestyle.
That's probably related, right? Same thing.
Nutritional status, metabolic status. It's all
right. When you look at people who have, and how many people have, you know, they're not frankly diabetic, but if you just randomly measure hemoglobin A1C on people, you know, probably 70% of patients are not in an optimal range with a hemoglobin A1C of less than 5.4. That means you're glycosylating cells. Mm-hmm. When you glycosylate skin cells, what happens, right?
Yeah,
it damages them. So basically, high levels of glucose floating around your system all the time are going to cause further damage in joints, in skin, wherever it may be.
Yes, definitely. So for pentosan polysulfate, if patients are interested in getting that, that has to be compounded. Is there sub-Q or oral?
Sub-Q injection that you do yourself. So it's twice a week. You do a sub-Q injection. So it doesn't have to go into the joint. In fact, it's best not inject it into the joint because it can create a little hemarthrosis, a little bleeding in the joint. But it's a sub-Q injection, simple to do. So we teach people how to just grab a little skin, do a little injection twice a week. Usually it takes a few months to start really having people notice the anti-inflammatory effects. The regenerative effects kind of go on over time. I can tell you I've been taking this drug now for about 3 years. And it's kind of slow, steady, where you're like, oh my gosh, I have no pain anymore, right? None. Mm-hmm. And I was at a state where my knees, yeah, I still did stuff because I pushed through pain. But, you know, skiing, I had both my knee braces on. I was, you know, it always hurt. Hiking, I had my walking sticks, my knee braces. I do it, but it always hurts, right? It was everything hurt. So you kind of push through the pain. Now I don't have any pain. 3 years in, I've not reimaged my knees. I kind of don't want to. But I'm guessing they probably look better than they did 3 years ago.
Interesting. And what's the dosage for that sub-Q?
It varies by weight of the patient. You know, typically we do about 125 milligrams twice a week. But that can vary depending on the condition, depending on the state of the patient. Sometimes you can go down to once a week, smaller people. Sometimes you can do a higher dose for a while and then drop down the dose. So it's variable. You do have to get it compounded from a good pharmacy. Not available as a research chemical. It's not available for you to get it, you know, over the counter anywhere or even on your black market sites. You're not going to find this drug. So it should be done with a physician's guidance. Its biggest side effect is it's a mild blood thinner. So about the same as aspirin or a baby aspirin, mild blood thinner. It's actually such a mild blood thinner that if you're on blood thinners, you can still do it. But you warn people of that, that basically if you're going to have surgery, you have to stop it, things like that, just like aspirin.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating. So that kind of was the beginning of your journey into really getting into using peptides and products and starting with knowledge.
Yeah. And PEPS is a repurposed drug. It's not a peptide. But repurposed drugs are cool. But you can find drugs that have one purpose. I mean, if you look at bladder inflammation, high levels of inflammatory cytokines, all these things going on in the bladder, it's like, oh, why might this not be going on somewhere else, right?
Yeah. And do you think the pentosan helps with other inflammatory areas?
Yes.
Like skin inflammation, gut?
So it has huge properties orally for the gut. So you can take it as an oral capsule. So oral, as Elmeron, is a high dose, but you can use a low dose, like 25 milligrams orally just for gut. It's a perfect prebiotic and anti-inflammatory for the gut. Mm. And it has huge antiviral properties. So it's actually a better antiviral than things like Valtrex. So so you're getting this nice antiviral protection, which is great in this day and age, right? To have that antiviral protection. So it's a great antiviral. It's a great anti-cancer agent as well. So it has a lot of other benefits. We also know that the same cytokines, like interleukin 1 beta particularly, that are elevated in osteoarthritis are elevated in cardiac disease. That's why if you have osteoarthritis, we used to think that the link between osteoarthritis and cardiovascular disease was simply because of people being more sedentary. Not so. It's because the same process is going on. The same cytokines are dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And so pentosan also appears to have some very nice benefits for cardiovascular protection as well. So it's good data on it for kidneys. More injectable than oral. For the oral I use primarily for gut, but I'll use injectable for kidneys, cancer, other things. And so it's got a lot of health benefits with a relatively low risk profile.
Amazing. So for your patients with ulcerative colitis, irritable bowel disease.
Yeah, it's worth trying a little oral dose of that. Yes.
Amazing. I love that. I want to dive right into the other fabulous thing that you're so well known for, which is peptides, and talking a little bit about it. My friends, my patients, myself, we're all starting to dabble in doing peptides, but I wanted to make sure to get out there to the aesthetic community like a real expert like yourself. You've really innovated the use of peptides, and I love that you read all the scientific literature. Tell us from the beginning, what's a peptide, how do they work, and why we should be using them?
So peptides are, they're basically in every cell in your body, and they perform a huge variety of functions, but pretty vital functions for everyday life. And to understand what a peptide is, it's similar to a protein. Whereas a protein is greater than 50 amino acids, a peptide is less than 50 amino acids. It can be all the way down to 2 or 3 amino acids. So think of it as a smaller chain of amino acids. And there's peptide, this is what we call peptide hormones. So basically peptides that act as hormones. Insulin. Insulin's a peptide. So basically, if you look at insulin, it has a very specific action. You eat glucose, it tells glucose to go into your cells. So most peptides have these very specific actions, wide variety of actions. As your body ages, just like your hormones decline, so do peptides decline. So peptide production just gets less and less and less as we get older and older. And as a result, we start seeing some of the same results. Because if you look at some of these things peptides do, like insulin, they're so critical to function that if we don't have them, our function will get worse and worse and worse, like age does, right? So I think peptides get a little bit, people get a little scared of them. Mm-hmm. And yet need to understand that they are very many of them, not all. We use peptides that are not endogenous to our bodies, but a lot of the peptides, especially the ones I want to talk about today, are endogenous. Your body makes them every day to do things like build muscle, burn fat, heal after an injury, target immune cells to make sure you don't attack your own cells, like autoimmunity, to help with libido, to help with sleep. Your body makes these peptides to do that. As those decline, just like you see with aging, we have less athletic performance, we have more body fat, we have less muscle mass, we don't sleep as well. That's all related to some of this decline in peptides and hormones. You know, hormones are still, you know, bar none, the probably top thing that you're going to need to replace if you kind of look at longevity. Mm-hmm. On our academy, which you kindly mentioned, so we have this Human Optimization Academy, which is designed for people to really be able to kind of deep dive stuff. We have these great Q&A sessions every month with really smart people. It's all kinds of people. It's physicians, it's health coaches, it's trainers. But the Human Optimization Academy gives a lot of courses. It's a good course on peptides. But one of them is I sort of put this course called What to Fix First. And the reason I did it was because all these biohackers, and you probably see this, okay, but all these biohackers come in, and literally they come in and they're doing their red light and their sauna. And they're, you know, and they've got literally three cages of supplements they hand me. And they've skipped the basics, which are sleep, nutrition, exercise. But so as I started to write the course, I was like, okay, so sleep, nutrition, exercise, those come first. And then it sort of occurred to me, if I try to ask a woman who has no progesterone to sleep, they can't. Progesterone is so essential to us to get deep sleep. And for us to calm our brain, it's like hormonal Valium. And most women's progesterone starts to drop at 30. So, so for me to ask a 6-year-old woman who has no progesterone to sleep, they're going to say, I can't. I'm awake all night. I have to pee a lot. My brain's going. So I decided probably know what to fix first. You've got to get hormones optimized first, right? So same thing with exercise. If I ask you to go exercise and you have no testosterone, you're not going to see the benefits, right? You're going to go lift weights. Have no muscle increase and go, well, this is stupid. All I do is feel sore and I'm not making any progress. So you have to get testosterone board, both men and women, right? Testosterone is imperative for men for healing, for sleep, for function in general. So, but women as well. So you have to get testosterone fixed. You got to get estrogen fixed so the person actually doesn't have hot flashes all night long, has normal bladder function, and you have to get progesterone fixed. And then you can move into your nutrition, exercise, and sleep, right, and get those optimized, because nothing's going to work until you get those optimized. I don't care. But I can use peptides to help there too. But I like to think them as the next tier, right? So I work on the other stuff, and then we go to the peptides, which are a little pricier, you know, and most of them are subcutaneous injections, so a little bit more tedious. Mm-hmm. There are some that are can be taken orally, but most you have to do is a subcutaneous injection.
Mm-hmm.
But we follow the same rule of thumb. Look at the things, before I get into fancy peptides, look at the peptides that I make that are dropping as I age, right? So what is the first one that really sort of think about that, you know, drops at a pretty young age? Our growth hormone levels, growth hormone is a hormone, but growth hormone stimulates the liver to make, so pituitary releases growth hormone. Yeah. Growth hormone tells the liver to produce insulin-like growth factor, IGF. IGF then has a dramatic effect on almost every tissue.
Yes.
It's bone, it's skin, it's brain, it's muscle, right? So if I have low IGF levels, and most people do as they get older, not all, but most as they get older. So you can measure your IGF levels and you can say, oh my gosh, I have an IGF level of 100. I'm not going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
When we're young, we have IGF levels in the 200s and 300s. We try and keep at least an optimal in that 170 to 190 kind of range for people. And we don't use growth hormone much because the downside to growth hormone is it's super physiologic. It's giving a big whopping dose of growth hormone, getting a big spike in growth hormone, getting a big spike in IGF. What we want is the body to do it a little bit more the way it does it itself. So we use what I call growth hormone secretagogues. And the most common ones are known as CJC, Ipamrelin, Tesamorelin. Usually you want to do what's called a growth hormone releasing hormone with a growth hormone releasing peptide. Mm-hmm. Think about the growth hormone releasing hormone as filling back up the gas tank, the growth hormone releasing peptide as hitting the gas pedal and releasing it. So what we do is have people, like, at night before they go to bed, they give themselves a little combination of GHRH, GHRP, and we usually use CJC, Ipamrelin. You can use Tesamorelin, Ipamrelin. And you do a little injection of that before you go to bed. Now, what am I going to do? I'm going to heal better. My deep sleep is going to be dramatically improved. If you have no growth hormone release at night, you're not going to sleep well. My skin regeneration is going to occur. My hair growth is going to be better. My brain function is going to be better. So that's a very simple thing that we know, just like your estrogen drops and your progesterone drops and your testosterone drops as you age, growth hormone drops. Except growth hormone drops very young. I mean, really, it starts dropping by 30.
But, I mean, it's fascinating that I think people are so intimidated with just fixing their actual sexual hormones and so under-equipped because the OB-GYN doctors don't know what to do.
Right.
Basic OB-GYNs that are out there now, they graduated 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, they're proficient in what they do, but they were never even taught a single word or chapter about, you know, hormone replacement.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you were done. I mean, they were done, you know, basically they were done treating patients after they had babies, right? That was, you know, it's kind of,
yeah.
Just ultimately that,
like
what our one
too much,
purpose
you get
is on life.
Surgery. Yeah, you're done, right. You get
don't
off
care, yeah, don't care about you that much, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, and then we screwed up a lot of women with hormones with using the wrong kind of hormones, using non-bioidentical hormones. And then we got the Women's Health Initiative study out, which terrified everybody because they showed that, you know, that bioidentical, they didn't use by, that non-bioidentical hormones caused cancer. Well, really, actually, that study, when you went back and looked at it, showed that estrogen actually reduced the risk of cancer. It was only the progestin, not progesterone, that increased the risk of cancer. And even the authors came back and retracted and said this was interpreted wrong, but that lives to this day, where women think that hormone replacement causes cancer, and it does not. Done safely and done correctly, it actually prevents cancer. So it is frightening that women are sort of being deprived of that. And men, you know, we're not replacing testosterone adequately in men. We're seeing young men with very low testosterone levels that really should be addressed because it's affecting their moods. They get irritable, they get anxious, they get ADD behaviors. So it's really doing a disservice to humans that we're so, you know, thinking this is a bad thing.
So you're saying start with sex hormones, then you're going to find a really good practitioner who will hopefully get you on maybe nighttime growth hormones, a little burst.
Right.
And then maybe people are nervous to start with growth hormones, but are there peptides that you would recommend?
So basically those are peptides, not growth hormones. So I don't use growth hormone. And the reason is, again, I'm getting super physiologic doses. Some people love growth hormone. I'm not going to knock the people who want to use it. But you're giving a big whopping dose of a hormone that does have some downsides. You're going to get some edema. You can get splenomegaly, liver enlargements. You can get organomegaly. When you look back at the old bodybuilders, remember all that kind of weird turtle bellies? Like, you could see the definition of the belly, but it was like turtled out like this.
Yeah.
That's actually was organomegaly from growth hormone. They actually, liver and spleen were bigger, and so they look, you know, like a turtle. And it's irreversible when that happens. So I'm not a big fan of growth hormone. So these are peptides. The growth hormone secretagogues are peptides, so they're very safe. You don't get these super physiologic surges. So it's much less scary than doing growth hormone. Not to say there's some cases maybe where you need growth hormone, and if people love their growth hormone, more power to you. But my preference is to do what the body does, and that's by releasing these peptides or giving these peptides that tells your body to do a physiologic release of it.
And that would be every night? So you'd be doing Ipamrelin?
You'd be doing 5 out of 7 days.
Wow.
So you give yourself 2 days off. That way you don't get involution of the receptor, so you do 2 days off. Right.
Okay.
But the dramatic improvement in sleep in so many people, oh my gosh.
Hmm.
I have so many people who, you know, they haven't slept. You put them on a little growth hormone secretagogue peptides, mm-hmm. and their sleep goes, you know, is dramatically better. I mean, that night.
That's amazing. And then looking at, would you kind of start with a biological age assessment, or you're looking at symptoms when you begin treating with other peptides?
Well,
how do you decide what a patient needs?
So the next step is to think about, okay, what else am I losing as I age, right? So we know that even without doing measurements, and, you know, and we could talk all day about biologic age measurements. I'm not a huge fan. There is a new company called Generations Lab, I think, that has actually, because they can actually look at very specific organ entropy, so we can actually sort of target different organs that maybe, but I only do those really after I've optimized somebody, because for me to get a biologic age on you, I'm still going to try and optimize you, right? And so it's sort of a waste of your money until I optimize you. And then if we want to, and then if you're just like, we want to sort of get to the next step and see, okay, well, why, you know, why am I not 100% yet? Then those biologic age tests, particularly Generations Lab, because again, it's looking very specific at some of these things that are released by organs as they're getting damaged. I'll give you an example. Like my biologic, I've done biologic age tests. They never tell me what else to do. I'm doing everything I can think of. Now what, right? So my biologic age may not come out as ideal as I want it. What do I do?
Yeah.
When I did a generations test, it actually showed that most of my organs were aging really slow. It was great. But my gut was not. Now I have no gut problems that I can think of. I don't have constipation. I don't have diarrhea. I don't have bloating. I don't have gas. But there was something wrong with my gut, right? Because this test says that organ is aging you more rapidly. So mm-hmm. it made me go get a gut test, do a GIFX test, look at my gut, and sure enough, my gut was not good. Even though it feels really? Fine, it was not good. So that's mm-hmm. why I like that test, because it can direct me now to say, okay, I've done everything I could think of, but I'm missing something, mm-hmm. and now I know what I'm missing. But in general, think about instead at that early phase of just trying to get healthy and trying to get your body in that perfect state. Again, what happens else with aging? Besides, we stop making growth hormone, we stop making IGF. The other big thing that affects our longevity and our health span is thymic evolution or involution. So basically your thymus gland, huge gland in your chest. You do an x-ray of a baby's chest, they have this giant mass in their chest, right? That's the thymus gland. As we age, it starts to shrink. So pituitary, it's at its biggest, doing a great job producing mm-hmm. thymic peptides. At puberty, it starts shrinking. By the time you're old like me, it is a little tiny nub. It's a fatty nub. It is not doing anything or very minimal. So people have tried doing things like in France, they eat sweetbreads. Sweetbreads are thymus gland, but that doesn't really work. Hmm. What we can do is give the body back what the thymus gland was doing, right? Mm-hmm. So just like the pituitary was releasing less growth hormone, I give back things that stimulate IGF, I'm going to give back the thymic peptides. I can't replace your thymus gland yet, maybe someday, but I can give you what it's doing. The biggest thymic peptide that is so important to longevity, because the biggest thing that's aging all of us is a decline in our immune system, mm-hmm. right? When we get a decline in our immune system, we get viruses, we get cancer, we get degenerative joint disease. Perfect immune system, you're going to stay pretty healthy, but none of us have perfect immune system. You can easily look at simple markers like your neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. So if you look at a CBC, look at that neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. If the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio is greater than 1.5 to 1, then you are getting immune dysfunction. So if you watch people as they age, you'll see their neutrophils will go up, their lymphocytes will go down. Mm-hmm. If you looked at an 18-year-old perfect immune system, they would have a 50-50 of neutrophils to lymphocytes.
Okay.
You want to keep that ratio. So those lymphocytes start going away. Well, because what do lymphocytes do? There are T lymphocytes. They make our T helper cells, our natural killer cells. They're our immune surveillance. So now we're losing natural killer cells, which decline dramatically at the age of 30, your natural killer cells, which are your cancer surveillance cells. We can't make antibodies as well. So we get a virus. We don't make antibodies. We don't get immunity to the virus. So then we get sicker and sicker and sicker every time we get the virus and we die. That's why older people died of COVID, right? So if we get, so thymus alpha 1, which is well known in other countries as the drug Xadaxin. So it's not available here in the U.S. It's widely used. Like if you're in India and you are getting chemotherapy, they are going to put you on Xadaxin to protect your immune system. Here, not available.
Everyone wants to know how to spell that.
Z-A-D-A-X-I-N.
Okay, good.
Xadaxin. So here, we can get it made as thymus and alpha 1. So it's a simple peptide called thymus and alpha 1. And what thymus and alpha 1 does is it stimulates natural killer cells. It retrains your immune system, your bone marrow, to actually make more lymphocytes again. And it basically activates plasma cells to make antibodies. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting the advantages of my thymus gland used to do when I was young. So young kids don't die of viruses very often, right? We do as we get older. And young kids rarely get cancer because their immune system surveillance system is so good. So we want to get that back. Mm-hmm. So by giving thymus and alpha 1 on, you know, at least a semi-consistent basis. In a perfect world, you would do it every day for the rest of your life. But that becomes difficult and not very affordable. So So what we'll do is lots of times cycle it. So we'll maybe do a 6-week course. You especially do it if you get sick or if you have cancer or you have an autoimmune disease, or let's say you just had a procedure, like you just did exosomes to your face or something like that, and you want to get your immune system in a perfect state, right? Then that's a great time to do something like thymosin alpha 1 or after surgeries. So we'll use it at those times. I take this drug a lot because I do have an autoimmune disease, so I do it on a more frequent basis. So my patients who have an autoimmune disease may be doing it 2-3 times a week for the rest of their lives because it keeps their immune system stable and healthy.
Nice. And then what kind of dosing are you recommending for that?
Again, dosing is really variable. You know, you're going to change it. Like if I have somebody who's sick, I'm going to do a very high dose of this. Kind of a typical dose might be 500, 750 micrograms of this drug, you know, three times a week. But that can, thymosin alpha 1, you could dose to infinity. It has no toxicity. So, you know, and it's a very well-tested peptide because it does have a drug counterpart, Zodaxin. Again, not available here in the U.S., God knows why, but available in other countries. So it's probably one of the more tested peptides in humans. And we know it's very safe, even at massively high doses. So we would, you could, during COVID, somebody got really sick, we would run an IV. I mean, you would give very high doses of this. So it kind of depends on what state you're treating because you can dose this drug high. I would say less than 500 micrograms, I don't see as much of an effect, so I want to keep it at least usually typically above that. And then again, it might be 3 times a week, it might be 6 days a week, 7 days a week. It depends on a lot of what I'm doing. I think dosing is hard to talk about when you're talking about peptides because it varies so much about what we're trying to treat with them. But sort of a standard, if I was doing longevity, you know, just sort of prevention, I might do it 6-week courses, 3 times a week at 750 micrograms, something like that.
And then go off for a little bit.
And then go off for a little bit. And I will tell you, the reason to go off is because it becomes financially difficult.
Yeah.
Peptides are not cheap.
I think the hardest thing about learning peptides for myself, I'm very evidence-based too. I do like a deep dive into the literature.
Right.
There's
not a lot of human literature.
There's very little literature on what's the right dose, what's the right frequency, what's the duration. Like, it's all, we need
right.
20 years of experience. Like,
yeah, and I'll tout, like, for those of you guys who want sort of just a basic handbook. You know, I love Dr. Seed's Peptide Protocols book. This is a great book if you guys just need like a guide on dosing of things, you know, simple explanations. This is sort of a great go-to handbook to just have on your, you know, it's simple. It tells you this is the dosing, this is what this does. So it's a nice little just keep on your desk kind of handbook to have. You know, I mean, Dr. Seed's is really one of the experts in this arena and that book is, if you're just getting started in peptides, I think it's kind of a must-have.
It's like the Bible.
Yeah, it's like the Bible for just dosing and things.
Starting out, yeah.
You know, and if you, you know, again, we'll vary those doses, but that's learning. You'll do a lot with just the dosing kind of things that he recommends in there. The other peptide your thymus gland makes that's so critical is thymus and beta-4.
Uh-huh.
The thymus and beta-4, on the other hand, is what thymus and beta-4 does is it has the ability to kind of attach to actin, which helps move cells, right? And so it's important for creating new blood vessels. It's important for reducing myofibroblasts so you don't get scarring, right? So after you do a procedure for someone and something so you don't get scarring, thymosin beta-4 is key because it will reduce this fibroblastic reaction in wounds. So you get a lot less scar and fibrotic tissue. So thymosin beta-4 it will use primarily for healing after a procedure or after surgery, or let's say somebody had myocarditis or pulmonary inflammation. Great, because what happens with myocarditis? You get myofibrosis, you get scarring of the heart, right? Or pulmonary fibrosis after you've had a bad heart, lung infection. So you're going to prevent that by putting people who are, you know, if they go through an illness on thymosin beta-4. And then we use a lot combined with another peptide called BPC.
Mm-hmm.
If you know one peptide and you want to use one peptide, body protective compound is it. So BPC and thymosin beta-4 are sort of synergistic for healing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that combination, BPC basically it's made by our gut. So again, another endogenous peptide. Again, not a lot of human studies, but in animal studies, again, safe to very high levels. Remember, these endogenous peptides and peptides, so you can overdose hormones much more easily than you can overdose peptides because peptides have very, very specific actions. hormones have a wide range of actions. So if you do give too much of a hormone, you're going to create more problems because they have very, very specific mechanisms to be able to be a little more forgiving. So mm-hmm. bioprotective compound is made by our gastric, by our gut. And it's present in all of your gastric juices. But when you have an injury, it goes to help heal that injury. And that's whether you have an injury to your gut. So this is great. If any of you guys who have, you talked about ulcerative colitis, ulcers, heartburn, BPC is a great orally for anything to do with the gut. But if you inject it, particularly combined with thymosin beta 4, and I will say most peptides, and you'll see this, and I'm going to warn you about this, because you will see a lot of people selling peptides mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
When you mix peptides, you're actually creating an unknown compound.
Mm-hmm.
Peptides are loose amino acid bonds. If I mix them together, they're going to go, oh, I like this guy better, and you're going to make a whole new peptide that you have no idea what it's doing. And it's where some of the complications have run with peptides and why, you know, when you read stories, sometimes you'll see people, a lot of times you're seeing people mix. I know a guy who sells peptides where he mixes, you know, a growth hormone secretagogue with BPC, with thymosin beta 4. You cannot do that. They each need to be a separate injection.
Yeah, they're trying to make it easy for the consumer.
Trying to make it, yeah, right. And in the process, making it unsafe and actually undoing the benefits of it. So you combine BPC, which has all these cytoprotective components, reduces oxidative stress, heals joint tissue. It is remarkable. BPC and thymosin beta 4 for healing a wound or healing a musculoskeletal injury. I had shoulder surgery last year and healed so much faster by using thymosin beta 4 and BPC. You just have to inject it sub-Q anywhere, but it does seem anecdotally a little better if you inject it close to the site. Like, so if, when I had my shoulder, I just used a little skin on my shoulder. It doesn't have to be intra-articularly, just subcutaneously. So those two, remember, for healing. So I guess, especially when you guys are doing any kind of aesthetic procedures, these is a really nice combination to put somebody on afterwards to help them heal much more rapidly and to help them prevent a lot of scarring or you know, fibrotic tissue, fibrosis. So those two, I think need to be on everybody's radar. And if I were to pick one peptide that I would use for almost anything, it would be body protective compound, BPC. Orally, if you've got gastric stuff, injectable if you're trying to treat more systemic stuff.
How about, I know copper is such a great peptide for skin. Are there any other newer, better ones or things that have come up in your research for skin quality and skin hydration and collagen production?
Yeah, I love GHK copper, right? So we'll mix it with argyroline and luphazole to help with fine wrinkles because argyroline and luphazole actually act kind of a Botox effect. So if you're doing Botox, it can work in between to kind of make the effects last longer. GHK copper is, you know, it's in so many things now, right? You can, in so many cosmetics, they've added copper peptides, but you really want a little bit more a good dose. So we get it compounded, so we get a pretty good dose of it. But remember, not just for skin, you know, healing there, but if you add an incision, putting the GHK copper over the incision is great. Also injecting GHK copper if somebody's trying to heal is really good. My mom, at the end of her life had this infection in her toe and they were going to amputate her toe. It's just not healing. And, you know, she's 9 years old. I didn't want to amputate her toe. And I just started putting GHK copper on that wound and it healed in like 4 weeks. So they're really, I love GHK copper. From another peptide perspective, I can't really think of something better than GHK copper kind of for that skin, but I do like, from a repurposed drug perspective, I love rapamycin skin cream. Are you using that at all?
I mean, I've seen the articles and the pictures. I haven't got it compounded yet, but it's very dramatic and it's amazing.
Actually. Yeah, people love it. And I actually haven't tried it just because I'm lazy.
What percentage are you using, or have you heard? I've heard 1% topical.
Yeah, 1 or 2%. Topical is usually good. And my patients who are using it, I mean, they love it. They, you know, the wrinkles, the dark spots, really quite dramatic. And it thickens skin. You think about what it's doing, right? Just like rapamycin systemically is acting to promote autophagy, right? So that's exactly what we're doing is we're getting rid of, you know, all the damaged cells. And getting rid of all the damaged cells allows, especially now when you're doing a procedure, that allows new cell formation to form. So I think that's a great option to use. Really prior to procedure, for instance, to be using rapamycin skin cream. Again, I have not tried it. It's more like just my laziness of buying it, but it's, but I will tell you, I would say bar none, my patients who have tried it, it's one of their favorite things for skin.
Are you doing rapamycin orally, or would you?
So I also
metformin,
a lot of rapamycin orally on a once a week basis as a longevity drug. Basically, rapamycin blocks mammalian targeted rapamycin, or mTOR. If we block, so remember there's always these balancing forces in us. We have mTOR and AMPK. AMPK, think about, that's the endurance runner. Just can go on and on and on, right? So we think about longevity, we want high AMPK. But like the endurance runner, right, they're sort of skinny. They don't have a lot of big muscle mass. Think of mTOR as the bodybuilder. So what we really want is we want AMPK to be running most of the time, but we got to push up mTOR up and down like this because I want big muscles. I want to be able to sustain a fall when I get older. I want to be able, you know, pick up kids and things like that. So if you just always are blocking mTOR, like things like metformin. Metformin is an mTOR blocker. I don't think you should do that continuously. And rapamycin is the same story. Basically, you want to off and on rapamycin. So once a week dosing, and that can vary. Most typical dosing is about 6 milligrams orally once a week. And that way, what you're doing is, I like to think about it as cleaning house, right? I'm throwing in all the trash. I blocked all of mTOR. I'm not going to be building it all. It's taking out all the trash. And now I spend the rest of my week kind of rebuilding a little bit. And I take out the trash the next week. So, you know, the data is, I think, more and more and more compelling that one of our best longevity drugs is probably going to be periodic rapamycin. I think we don't have a great handle on what the correct dose is. I think most of us are using a 6 milligram dose with a, that seems right based on the animal studies. We have a lot of studies going on. So we have a group of longevity docs who are all collecting data. But I will tell you, most longevity docs are on rapamycin.
Interesting. Because then I've heard some people say, well, it prevents, you know, that growth phase because it's always turning things down and off.
And that's why you don't want to use it continuously, right?
Yeah,
so that's why it's a chemotherapeutic, is because you don't want any growth in cancer. So in cancer, you're going to take it every day.
Yeah.
And cancer is the antithesis. Unfortunately, we've got to stop all growth. So my cancer patients, I'm going to, you know, put them on metformin and things like that because I don't want growth. Cancer is trying to keep the patient alive while you're killing the cancer, but you're not going to have the patient thriving so much while you're trying to kill cancer. You're going to just kind of get them healthy enough. What we want is, yes, turn it off, then let it come back up. And that's why you want to do it periodically once. And then on that day, you're not going to be doing your big hard workouts because it's futile. You're not going to be in a big muscle mass.
Like your Sunday rest day or something.
That's exactly. That's what I do is my Sunday, you know, all I do is some general yoga on Sunday. So.
And that'll be like a one-time oral dose and that's like 150 milligrams or something like that.
It's like 6 milligrams.
Oh, geez. Okay, no,
it's tiny. It's a small dose.
Are you also taking any other senolytics? Like, are you a big believer in the supplements? What supplements are your regimen?
I think if you look at the data, fisetin and desinib are kind of the best testing there. Maybe quercetin and fisetin. I don't use those. I'm using primarily rapamycin as my senolytic. I do think when we look at senomodulators, we're going to do that a lot more of what we're doing sometimes with peptides and things like that, as opposed to kind of some of the senolytics.
Hmm. So you think that's a stronger, better route than maybe supplements?
I think actually this point has the most data behind it.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of things that are, you know, telmisartan at a low dose, which is a blood pressure medicine. I do that. I do it for that primary for exercise performance. They're all really cool repurposed drugs. But I think if you get your body, and this is too where the GLP-1 agonists are so helpful, right? GLP-1 agonists, I know they've gotten such a bad rap, you know, and you guys get the Ozempic face and stuff, but honestly, you do not lose muscle mass on GLP-1 agonists unless you do not eat protein.
Exactly.
So if you eat protein, you will lose fat, not muscle. Now, in your face, that's a problem because when you lose fat in your face, you look older. But in
the
rest of us.
We have a solution for that.
You've got the solution for that, right? Yeah.
And we have fat replacement products. It's the people who don't come in that have problems, but if you can prevent all that.
So would you do that? You would do that actually when they start or after they've kind of finished the GLP-1, you start doing the collagen stimulation?
Yeah, right when you begin your GLP-1s is the right time to do a facial assessment and a first session of collagen stim because it takes 60 days, 90 days to collagen. So it actually gets timed with about every 10 pounds you lose, you should come in and get some collagen.
Interesting.
And, you know,
that's great. Assessment. That's great information.
Yeah, and our current study that we're going to publish shows that the face does not atrophy, does not change, and maintains volumes when we do this protocol.
So wow.
Really interesting.
Yeah, it's great.
To your point, I wish Peter Attia would retract all his statements.
I do, too. I mean, unfortunately, the press continues to thrive on the – you guys, the GLP-1 agonists, if you had one longevity drug They are liver protective. They are neuroprotective. Actually, it has neurogenesis. It has brain growth. They're so cardioprotective. They're great for, you know, keeping your liver healthy, kidneys healthy. This one drug has so many powerful benefits, way beyond its weight loss. I'm too skinny. I don't need to take a GLP-1 agonist, but I take a very low dose twice a week for my brain. Because the neuroprotection, I mean, there are phase 4 trials for neurodegeneration. The neuroprotective benefits are huge. So if you have, you know, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, you have fatty liver disease, this is a drug you should be on. If you don't want to lose weight, do a low dose of it. They still have benefits.
That's amazing. What else can you take for peptides that are cerebral protection for brain fog and like just memory loss?
There's some great ones. Two of kind of the most famous are what are called C-Lank and C-Max. Mm-hmm. So C-Lank and C-Max are nasal spray peptides. One of the great things is that the nose and has direct access to the brain. That's why you can do pituitary surgery just through the nose. So by spraying something in your nose, you can get a very direct effect. And C-Lank and C-Max came from Russia, Dr. Cavinson's lab, and Dr. Cavinson did a lot of research with these. They have been using them for a long time, but they can be made here. Where C-Lank, think about it as kind of your brain settling. It's very anti-inflammatory to the brain. So when we look at a lot of neurodegenerative diseases or anxiety diseases or bipolar or schizophrenia, those are neuroinflammatory diseases. So we need to reduce brain inflammation. So C-Lank will dramatically reduce brain inflammation. It will help calm the brain. So those people who are kind of in this, you know, your ADD, your anxiety people, or depression people, that can be super helpful because a lot of those are neuroinflammatory diseases. And then you can use it with its sister peptide, C-Max. And what C-Max does is think about it more as the kind of stimulating focus. I'm going to be able to kind of create and do things. And they were actually kind of developed for the athletes, actually for the military. So the military, because obviously you need to be calm and focused if you're shooting somebody. And the same thing is true if you're looking at sports. So they use them a lot in that realm. But in our world, that's kind of the best state for our brain to be in, right? Calm and focused. So by doing a combination of C-Lank and C-Max, I can get up and speak in front of a crowd and be very calm but very focused on what I'm talking about. Or if you're going to do an exam, right, you could do those two together. And anybody who's neurodegenerative diseases, that is a neuro – you have to remember there's always markers. We can look at markers like quinolic acid, things like that tell us there's neuroinflammation. And those people need C-Lank because they've got to get the inflammation down out of the brain. So I love those two. Another pep called Dihexa. It's actually been researched a lot for Parkinson's, but it also can have some nootropic effects as well. And it can actually be bought even as a supplement. So you can actually buy Dihexa. It's that benign as a supplement now.
And what would be the dose of that?
I can't remember the exact dose. Usually it's like two caps that you would take. Can't remember offhand the oral dosing of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I know like OHP Health has it. Has Dihexa as a supplement, so two caps of that a day. That can act as a nice nootropic. Some people really feel that a lot, some people not so much, but those are really nice, simple things that you can do to keep your brain a little more focused. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of IV cerebrolysin. Mm. Cerebrolysin is a multimodal peptide. It's actually a whole bunch of peptides mixed together. It is widely used in Austria and Asia for if you have a stroke or you have a brain injury or you have dementia, they will be using cerebrolysin on you. It is not available here. And the company who makes it, called Everpharma, has no desire to try and get it available here because they would have to get every peptide that's in it authorized. It would take them 100 years. So we have it shipped over from Austria. It has 20 years of human testing in Austria, in India. So it's another one of those like Zadaxin that is very tested and dramatically improves people if you've had a stroke or a brain injury, particularly the more acutely you can do it. But we use it a lot for just, you know, depression, anxiety, people who have cognitive decline. You can come in and do IV infusions of it. You know, usually we have people come, fly out here, stay for 5 days, do daily IV infusions at high dose, and then maybe come back like once a month or once every couple months to kind of, depending on what their state is. So cerebrolysin is actually an incredible peptide, but not very available, a little pricey. But again, if you look at things that are well tested, this is a well tested peptide.
What do you think are going to be the innovations in this next, you know, like 5 year decade, with the Trump administration? Hopefully, the FDA getting things approved a little.
Yeah, faster. I mean, I hope that, you know, RFK Trauma makes all his promises, you know, come true and makes a lot of these things more accessible and hopefully less expensive for people, because these are so preventative for all these chronic diseases. So I hope the agenda of, you know, making hormones more accepted and understood and available, making peptides more accepted and understood and available, I think is going to be huge. I think where we're going to see huge developments is with the ability of AI to figure out novel peptides for treating different pathways. We're all about cellular pathways. So I look at a disease or aging and what cellular pathways are becoming dysfunctional. So now if I know what pathways I really need to address, I can feed into AI. I go, hey, design me a peptide that's going to address this very particular pathway, right? Without AI, we could never do that. It would take us, you know, but we look at the escalation of knowledge now, we're going to be able to develop these novel drugs and novel peptides that are safer and more specific to these diseases related to aging in a fraction of a second versus what was taking us 10 years to do.
Interesting. Are you doing any clinical trials or things like that with the...
So right now we're doing some clinical trials with rapamycin, and we're doing clinical trials on GLP-1 agonists just to get more data out there for GLP-1 agonists on the safety perspective and all the other huge benefits of it, because we want more data out there. So, you know, so many of things we're doing in longevity medicine are kind of N-of-1 data. So we have a group of about 250 longevity docs from across the world that are kind of accumulating all of our data together and being able to put that in, you know, some steps. It's just, you know, this doc doing this. Now we have a conglomerate of information. So that'll be nice. You know, again, that's where being able to use AI to help us has been dramatically changing that field.
That's incredible. I'm such a huge fan, and I think you're doing the most amazing work getting knowledge out there just at the basic level to providers and people who want to get into, you know, the science of cellular medicine. But where can people find you, and where are you lecturing next? And I know I'm going to see you at the Octane meeting in January.
Yeah, Octane in January. Then I'm going to be in New Orleans, January 17th and 18th, doing sort of a grand rounds thing where people kind of come and present cases. It's really cool if any of you guys have difficult cases that you kind of want to talk about. We actually have sort of a group of faculty for my scientific research and performance group that comes and people just present cases. So that's fun. That's in New Orleans, January 17th and 18th. You go to SSRP, you can find that. So that's January. February, I'll be lecturing at the IHS conference and then another conference called CALM, which is a great place for those of you guys who are just getting into peptides. CALM is a conference that is going to be kind of basically trying to put this into a really easy to understand perspective across every field, right? So CALM, C-A-L-M, I've looked that up. That's at the end of February. I think that's going to be a tremendous conference. It's a new conference that Leonard Pastrana for New BioAge is putting together that I think will be tremendous. So those are places I think you guys could, you know, if you want to really present cases, the Grand Rounds is a great place to go, but come to CALM. It's a really great thing. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Yearth. Please, our website's BorderLongevityInstitute.com. If you're interested, you can fill out I want information. We have a great person who can call and give you all the information. Our academy is BLI.academy. Those of you who really want to gig out on this stuff, the people on the academy gig out on this stuff. And I love the Q&As because they're incredibly challenging. But we talk about so many new novel things and people throw out cases. It's a lot of fun. So BLI.academy, if you join that, That's a great place to learn. You have access to all the videos and things like that, too. And then just at Boulder Longevity Institute for other Instagram, too.
Well, this has been amazing. I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to meet you in person as well. And hopefully we'll get some future collaborations. I'm definitely inviting you to lecture at some coming up meetings.
Great.
Well, guys, that's it for now. Oh, yes. I hope that you will all dive into, you know, your beauty and your health and longevity at the cellular level. This is what we need to do. Unfortunately, there's not a lot out there that physicians know. So it's time to self-educate and just get started on this journey, because there's so much we can do. And the next 50 years is going to bring tremendous innovation in terms of all the cellular medicine.
Yeah.
That's it for now. Stay beautiful. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, D-R-K-A-Y. And our website is the same. It's beautybydrk.com. That's where you can find our amazing skincare line and also collagen peptides, which I'm going to send you some to try, some skincare and some peptides. And come and see me if you're in California and in Los Angeles. We can definitely prevent Ozempic face. And we need to do another podcast talking about, like, the cellular metabolism and, you know, all the things that you're so passionate about. And I want to talk about exosomes, polynucleotides, and kind of, you know, what we're doing in aesthetics. It's so next.
I'd love to hear more of that.
Yeah. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.
Bye, guys. Thank you.